Mike Pence picks Sue Ellspermann to be his running mate. John Gregg picks Vi Simpson. How do the candidates for lieutenant governor match up? Joe Donnelly goes after the farm vote. Indianapolis considers same-sex benefits, and Grant County creates a dress code. That plus our annual Indy 500 picks and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending May 25,
12. Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. The path to a successful business has unexpected twists and turns. The legal professionals at Ice Miller are dedicated to guiding businesses along the journey. Experience takes businesses to the top. Ice Miller can help them stay there. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.
This week, Mike Pence, the Republican candidate for governor, picked first-term state representative Sue Ellspermann to be his running mate. Ellspermann is an engineer who leads a business incubator at the University of Southern Indiana. She was immediately confronted with questions about voting as a Democrat in the 2008 primary. That's when President Obama and Hillary Clinton were on the ballot here.
Why did you vote in the Democratic primary?
Do you remember what was happening in 2008?
Did you do it to vote for Barack Obama?
Oh, I voted because I wanted to help make the decision Indiana was likely to make that night. Indiana was likely to make the decision that evening on who would be the presidential candidate.
What does Sue Ellspermann bring to the GOP ticket? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Eric Holcomb, John Schwannis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Wish TV Statehouse reporter Jim Shella. Ann Delaney, you can't complain about somebody who voted Democrat just 4 years ago, can you?
Somebody voting Democrat on direction of Rush Limbaugh,
She said she didn't do it on direction of Rush Limbaugh.
She? Does she remember that? Because she didn't remember that she'd voted Democratic when she was in front of the State Election Commission.
She now remembers.
And now she remembers it wasn't following Rush Limbaugh's advice. Look, all this does for their ticket is solidify the position as a total Tea Party ticket. I mean, I didn't think there was any room to the right of Mike Pence, but if there is, she's there. So you have Pence, and then you have the lieutenant governor, and you have Murdoch, and it's a total Tea Party appeal. No deviation from the orthodoxy anywhere down the line.
She's been involved in some anti-abortion legislation, but she's generally considered to be more moderate than Mike Pence.
More moderate than Mike Pence. That's like saying you have more life than my pet rock. It's just not, you know, there is no such thing as putting Mike Pence in moderation in the same sentence.
She's an absolute ideal choice for lieutenant governor. She's got the real world experience, the private sector, the higher education background that will serve Mike Pence well.
But she's unknown. I mean, if she had all of that and she was well known, that would be ideal.
She's been highly successful as a trailblazer in her own right throughout life, so she'll get well known fast.
Sometimes not being well known can be an advantage. I think we've seen candidates who have sought running mates because they think they're a clean slate, there's no baggage. Sometimes it works, and sometimes they're famous instances where it doesn't work. But I mean, she, for the reasons mentioned, she's a sort of a conventional wisdom pick in a lot of ways. With the Republican Party, you want the business, private sector bona fides, as Eric mentioned. She has that clearly. A lot of her life has been devoted to developing business, nurturing young businesses and growing them. Then you have a woman at a time when you have the message from the Democratic side of this race that Republicans, this is the attack on women, the war on women year, so you have a woman to temper that. And she's from the southern part of the state where John Gregg, the Democratic nominee for governor, is from. I mean,
actually,
not exactly the same
four,
spot, but certainly in the southern part of the
state. All four nominees are from south of U.S. 40.
That may be a first, I would guess.
I think it may be. Did Mike Pence need to pick a woman?
Well, I don't think he needed to, but it certainly helps. And it helps for the reason that John talked about with the perception that Republicans have problems with women right now. So I think that it does that. And also, when she hit the legislature, I mean, her credentials as a business person, as a consultant, as a person in that tech transfer job at University of Southern Indiana are all very strong. But what happened when she came to the legislature was she hit it really hard and impressed a lot of people with her ability to, one, pick up the process, and two, become pretty heavily involved in it in a hurry. So she's, you know, got a lot of momentum going for her, and I think it's, you know, it's that's what they were looking for.
But I don't think that the mere fact that she's a woman does enough, because if all of the positions that they take are anti-women, the fact that you put a woman, it reminds me of what was said by the pollsters when George H.W. Bush picked Dan Quayle, saying, well, we have a problem with women, we'll pick a good-looking man, therefore all the women will come to us. Most women voters are smarter than that, and they'll look at the issues.
It's laughable to say that women have a war on women. And in Indiana, quite honestly, the perception is only the talking points the White House puts out about this war on women. We have a female Republican lieutenant governor. We have a female Republican secretary of state. We're probably going to send two female congressional candidates to Congress from Indiana as Republicans. We added female candidates in the state house, and we have three more running who are likely to win as well. So if that's a problem, I'll take more of them.
And you make war on the Girl Scouts as a communist organization with lesbians in it.
Girl Scouts.
And you have all
we
the
did.
Legislation to go, well,
what?
Republican,
there was no, there was
Republican
no
Party people did. And you take a vote. You go after young women's health care. You do all kinds of things in that regard that are definitely
state
anti-women and their issues.
State chairman supports the Girl Scouts.
Let's move
well,
on.
Well, that's good.
Democrat John Gregg named his running mate the next day.
Suspense left by the time John Gregg and Vi Simpson walked out of the state house together, but both did their best to create some excitement. Simpson is pro-choice, Gregg is pro-life. In fact, their politics on social issues are far apart, though Gregg tried to downplay it.
But she is more liberal than you.
Well, about everybody's more liberal than me.
Did you need that in a running mate?
No. I needed a running mate who was qualified to serve.
Is it your job to energize the Democratic base?
I hope I can. I hope I can. And I do think that we appeal to different constituency groups, and that's a good match.
Rick Holcomb, she makes a big difference for John Gregg, doesn't she?
Sure. I think it was a necessary pick for John Gregg to use a timely example. John Gregg's campaign certainly hasn't been clicking on all cylinders coming out of the first turn at the moment, and he needed to reach out to the far left of the party, and she checks every single box there.
Well, he needed to energize the base. I mean, I
don't think he needed to energize the base, because I think the base is energized.
Labor was lukewarm.
Labor was going to come on board because they want Obama, they want Donnelly, they want Gregg, and they don't want Mike Pence and Richard Murdoch. So that was not going to be a problem. I think what this, you don't have to convince me that Vi Simpson's a qualified candidate. I supported her in 2003. I would have supported her if she ran again this time. She's an excellent choice. But what this shows more is John Gregg's leadership style. He's not afraid of people with differing opinions. He's not afraid to sit down at the table and see if there's common ground. It doesn't have to be the lemming orthodoxy of the Tea Party. He is willing to explore other ideas, and that's to his credit.
Well, their politics are very different.
Well, of course they're very different, and I actually concur with Ann on this point. I think that it makes a lot of sense to pick somebody with perspective that's different than yours for the purpose of appeal. And what is wrong with having people with different points of view? That's not a criticism of the choice of Sue Ellsperman. I think it's a credit to John Gregg, however, that he did pick somebody with divergent points of view.
All right, I've said, though, this is kind of an all-or-nothing strategy, because the Democrats looked at what's going on in the House of Representatives and felt that they couldn't make many gains, and so they were encouraging people to run for seats in the state Senate and contributors to donate to the state Senate, and she's the point person there, and now she's gone doing something else. That's a problem for the Democrats, right?
Maybe not ideal if you're trying to pick up seats in the Senate, but I'll agree with what has been said here. I think it's a good, solid pick, strategically sound pick. Clearly, you have someone who's very qualified with her years, as shown by her years of service in the legislature. She is familiar with the political side and grassroots organizing because of the short-lived bids.
Yeah, she's raised $1 million in 2003.
Office in the past. So I think that that makes sense. The only thing we talked a moment ago about long record, well-known versus no record, after you've been in a legislative body for a couple decades, it makes it easier for opposition researchers to find something that could be taken out of context And well, again, that's
that. Well, just,
but generally, true. Generally, the running mate doesn't matter much, right?
Generally, it can be very helpful and it can complement your efforts. And you certainly are going to confront value issues. I mean, whether you want to showcase those issues, the legislators will bring those, and the people may have something to say about them. So this is going to turn into a Vice Simpson versus John Gregg debate more than it is a John Gregg versus Mike Pence. And I would just say, in response to Ann, that if Vice Simpson and Nancy Pelosi, and now you've got Bernie Sanders coming in for your state Democratic Party convention, Bernie Sanders, a devout socialist, if that's not the far left, I can't see any further left.
Okay, so you brought in, let's see, you had Herman Cain and Sarah Palin involved in your primaries. That's not the far Tea
Party, Bernie Sanders running for president?
Is that the he wasn't running for president when he came here, Herman Cain. So my point is only that, you know, we have a big tent. And we are not the kind that have the litmus test that it's either our way or the highway, which is what the Tea Party and currently the Republican Party stands for.
You know, Jim, if there were guilt by association, somebody ought to call the sheriff, because both of these two are guilty of that today.
Well, you hang out here too, so you'd be just as guilty.
Dude, a nickname is born.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific poll question in connection with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question is, who is the strongest running mate? Your choices are A, Vice Simpson, B, Sue Ellsperman, or C, Brad Klopfenstein, the Libertarian. Last week's question was, is it a good idea to cut corporate taxes? 44% said yes, 17% said why not income taxes, 39% said we can't afford it. To take part in the poll, just go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Ethanol and a federal mandate to include ethanol in gasoline is a big issue in the Senate race. Democrat Joe Donnelly took a tour of an ethanol plant in Alexandria to show his support for the ethanol industry and the farmers who depend on it. He also wanted to make a political point.
Richard Murdoch is against ethanol. Was wrong on his statements that ethanol is more expensive than gasoline. It's a lot less expensive. And when you're from Indiana and you can promote homegrown products that create energy independence and lower prices, I'm for it.
The Murdoch statements he's talking about were made in the GOP primary debate when the candidates were asked about the high cost of gasoline.
Suddenly we saw more ethanol being mandated into our gasoline, and we didn't even have an argument there to be made.
He suggested looking for more oil.
To get the price of gasoline back down, we have to not only do more drilling, but we certainly have to do more to get the EPA off the backs of the refiners, so that we can increase our refining capacity.
Donnelly says he was stunned by those comments. He sees an opening.
John Katzenberger, can Donnelly win the farm vote?
You know, it's going to be a tough pull. It'll be a hard thing for him to do, but I do think he has that opening that you talked about. You know, from a farmer's perspective, he's right on this issue. And as we all know, Senator Lugar was a leader in the farm movement. Now, he had a share of detractors from some of his past farm bill efforts, but I think that given the way the primary turned out on the Republican side, it's possible that Joe Donnelly could pick up that vote.
See, in the primary debate, Richard Murdoch was making this free market argument, this get the government out of things argument that appealed to Tea Party supporters. Do you see him abandoning that sort of approach?
I think the challenge anybody has who advocates the extracting government from our everyday lives, it may sound good in theory, especially when you're appealing to Republican voters in a primary season. But then when you get down to the practical applications, well, what federal programs are you going to scale back or do away with? Where are you going to push the federal government out of the sector? And that's where you run into trouble with the specifics, as is the case right here with the farm. With the governmental support of the ethanol industry as it relates to what we put in our cars. So he's making some inroads. I think John is, or Toots is right about. I told you that's a good nickname we're going to stick with.
Where does that come from?
Don't pay Never attention, mind. Jay. Let's go on with the question.
The other thing, one other thing is that he's going on the offensive, which I think it's clear that he wants to.
He wants to define himself.
He wants to define himself. He's not going to make a mistake.
And Murdoch. Yeah, that's right.
That Richard Lugar may have made.
Well, that's right. 40% of Indiana corn goes to ethanol. And the federal subsidy has gone away. But there's a mandate there that says, essentially, you need to use corn instead of foreign oil. I mean,
it's all part of a larger debate, obviously. The president said he would have an energy policy. We don't have that. The president says he's for an all the above approach. That means above ground. It doesn't mean coal, or it doesn't mean natural gas. It doesn't mean oil, obviously. And what Richard Murdoch was referring to with the mandates, et cetera, was that that's hindering some of that exploration and production. The price of gas is obviously mostly tied to OPEC, and to think otherwise is just pandering, and I suspect.
But he also said in that debate that putting ethanol in gasoline drives up the cost of gasoline, but ethanol is cheaper than gas. I mean,
it's all part of a bigger policy.
That was a great non-answer. You get the tap dance of the day award on that one. Because the problem is, this is a no-brainer. I mean, we have a renewable source of energy that Indiana grows, okay? It produces over $3 billion of revenue for the state. It employs 3,500 people, and it's renewable. And on top of that, it's cheaper than foreign oil. And on top of that, it is also better for the environment. It is a no-brainer. They've taken away, when he's talking free market, they took away the subsidies, the tax credits for that. They took away the import duties for bringing this in from South America, which was one of the other objections. And the market's going gangbusters. Murdoch is completely wrong on this question, and he stays in this position, and he's going to regret it, and he should.
Moving on, efforts are underway this week to give domestic partners of city-county employees in Indianapolis the same benefits as married couples. Democratic City-County Councilor Angela Mansfield is the sponsor of the bill. She says it's about fairness and economics as Indianapolis tries to compete to attract the best and brightest to city government. And she has bipartisan support, including a Republican co-sponsor, Bob Lutz.
They have a domestic partner, somebody that they're in a committed relationship with. I think it's important that they can go to work every day as an employee of the city and know that domestic partner is going to be considered and taken care of under our health plan.
John Schwanis, will that meet with approval from the mayor?
Well, the mayor has said, the mayor's office has indicated they'll look at this and see what actually shows up on his desk, if anything does. But I think he has shown that he's not an ideologue. He has tried to portray himself as just the opposite, as a can-do mayor who doesn't worry necessarily about the doctrine of a particular party. And if he views this as an economic development issue or a competition issue, as was just as the backers of this say, not only fairness but also it appeals to companies that may want to recruit the best and brightest to this community. Well, then that's an argument that will prevail. And if you look at the social trends, Indiana probably is not where some other states and municipalities are, but the trend lines, I think, on this issue are clear.
Eli Lilly, Cummins, Emmis, all have these benefits for their employees.
Yes.
So you wouldn't be out of line with the corporate leadership in the
city. Oh, absolutely. You'd be in line with corporate leadership. In fact, a couple of years ago, it was that corporate leadership that helped to defeat the effort to make this a constitutional question, which is, again, on a part of the legislature coming forward. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens between if Indianapolis adopts this policy and other corporations continue to adopt this policy for the same reasons that Indianapolis is looking at it, how the legislature will react and whether or not it will approve the resolution to put this question on a ballot after 2014. So I think that the mayor may find himself in the crosshairs of some of his fellow Republicans, but I think that it is, as John described, the way things are going right now.
And you've got this huge same-sex marriage debate taking place in Indiana and around the country. But back in 2004, George W. Bush came out in favor of civil unions. Mm-hmm. You can't be in favor of civil unions and be against this.
No, I don't think you can. I don't think you should be against this from an economic development point of view either. But it not only puts him the mayor, if he goes along with it, and that city councilman at odds with some of the Republicans in the legislature, it's going to put him at odds with Pence and Murdoch on this question as well, because both of them are opposed to it.
Joe Donnelly and John Gregg are opposed to same-sex marriage.
Well, they're opposed to same-sex marriage. It's not the same thing. It's not the same thing as allowing benefits well, this isn't, by the way, as I understand it, just some same-sex relationships.
Domestic partners. Right, right.
And they've not come out opposed to vote to that.
So you're in favor of discussing socially divisive issues now.
You're the ones bringing the socially divisive issues up, except in the gubernatorial campaign.
Is this a socially divisive issue?
Oh, yes.
Don't you think? Sure. And it'll be handled by a city-by-city basis.
Are you in favor of it?
Unless the legislature preempts it all with the constitutional question.
Yeah, you said you're in favor of Girl Scouts. Are you in favor of this?
I am in favor of Girl Scouts.
Okay, how about this?
And I'll support them.
How about this?
And I'll support the cities as they determine their futures will be played out.
So is that a yes?
It's a home rule argument is what that is.
If the mayor says yes, you're in support of it.
I will stand behind the mayor.
Okay, good.
All right, there's a new dress code this week at the Grant County Courthouse in Marion.
Terry Fetz tried to attend a hearing in the Grant County Courthouse wearing a tank top. He was denied entry and came away unhappy.
Well, it doesn't matter what I wear. You know, I'm there to support somebody, not to please them.
No short shorts, no micro mini skirts, tank tops.
Across the street, attorney David Glickfield reads the dress code that spells out fashion failures no longer permitted in courtrooms.
Halter tops, tube tops, see-through clothing.
This court order mandating a dress code may be the first of its kind in the state. The judge who drew it up, Dana Kenworthy, says she was motivated by an incident on Monday.
It involved a spectator there to support a defendant in a criminal case.
And she came up, to put it bluntly, with most of her rear end hanging out of her shorts.
David Glickfield tells the story of a mother trying to maintain custody of her children.
And mom came into court literally looking like she just came from the swimming pool.
Now that mother would be sent home to change.
Ann Delaney, is a dress code necessary?
Well, you would like to think that people going into those situations would know how to dress appropriately. But frankly, there's been such a breakdown in somehow communicating that to different, and it's not just the younger generation either, it's the older generation. We've gone so casual with this that people show up for graduations and weddings and you know, very serious events looking like they just came off the swimming pool or the golf course. And I think particularly in court where you have, you know, the ability to lock people up there and you have freedom itself at stake, it wouldn't be too much to ask them to put a shirt over that undershirt.
Take the hat off. One of the things on the don't list there was pajamas and slippers, and they say they encounter that a lot.
This one sounds like a slow news week to me.
This is the first county in the state to do this. And Judge Kenworthy said she immediately heard from somebody in another county who said it's a great idea. They intend to copy it.
I'm thinking you asked last week. I'm thinking of a number or what is your favorite color? Because this whole question is a little out there in and of itself. To Ann's point, I think a little respect goes a long way, especially in a courthouse.
You know, on the East Coast and the West Coast, when you watch some of these high-profile trials, they always hear about these consultants that the defense teams hire to figure out, assess the dress of potential jurors and advise their clients what to wear. I think maybe there's a cottage industry that could grow up here. Maybe there's some economic, potential here.
The Washington Post today tweeted that for four straight days, John Edwards has worn a green tie into his trial. Now, this is a little bit ridiculous, all right?
I
think people should respect the institution. They should wear appropriate clothing. I just think that this whole thing is.
What do you do if they don't? I mean, what do you do? I really don't have a quarrel with what that judge did because it sounds to me like there are a number of people going over the line, don't you think?
But it applies to people in the gallery. It's not just people who are appearing before the judge.
Yeah, but you're in a courthouse.
Well, I'm waiting for her to show up on Tyra Banks' show then and judge the clothing that these models are wearing because,
it's not the same, and you know it. You're getting me the First Amendment stuff again.
I'm giving it a little push, Ann. Yeah. I'm trying.
It may be the first year, but the U.S. Supreme Court, I know because we went and tried to get in for an oral argument. They do purport to have a dress code, although from what I could judge in the gallery, it was not enforced.
So you were in the cheap seats? As opposed to
Grant County, where now the deputies are also the fashion police.
Oh, boy. You waited a long time for that, Jim.
Thank you. Finally, time for our annual Indy 500 picks. Eric Holcomb, who's going to win the race?
Went to school, Pike High School, with a good friend of mine who works for Penske, and he'll be running the Willpower car, so that's who I'm for.
Willpower.
I'm going with Anna Beatrix.
And where's she starting?
She's starting at 15.
Yeah, she's...
No, she's up
she,
there.
She ran well in practice.
Right.
Yep.
I think it's an Andretti's year, so I'm going to go with Marco.
Stealing my thunder.
Sorry.
All right, we got two votes for Marco.
I'm going to go... Penske somehow figures out Indy.
Four races of the year?
I'm going with Elio. That would be his fourth win. Become
put him up in Rick Mears territory, Al Senior.
That's right.
Okay.
And given your dancing today, you should have voted for Elio Castroneves as well.
Yeah, that's right.
There you go. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Eric Holcomb, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/podcast, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity or Bright House Networks. I'm Jim Shella of Wish TV. We'll see you again next week.
Ice Miller, proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Things can go wrong in a thousand different ways. Businesses need a law firm that knows the thousand and first. The team of legal professionals at Ice Miller is committed to helping put the pieces back together. Ice Miller, it's a complex world. Be advised.